Welcome. My name is Patrick Curran, and along with Bernie Sanders mitten-wearing co-host Greg Hancock, we make up Quantitude. We are a podcast dedicated to all things quantitative, ranging from the relevant to the completely irrelevant. In this episode, we again subcontract out our own work by inviting a range of experts from different disciplines to share their perspectives on the future of teaching quantitative methodology. Along the way, we also discuss revenge, cryogenics, evacuation American Idiot, 11 Reasons Why We Blink, Being Hardly Sorry, Googling How to Fly a 737, Machine-Directed Latent Mixture Basket Weaving, NR, The Levy Series, No Half Measures, Penguin Freezers, The Suez Canal, John Wesley Powell, Pacific Naval Warfare, and Ignoring Dan McNeish. We hope you enjoy today's episode.
Hello?
It's Roy.
Who?
Roy Levy. You asked me to submit a few minutes of audio on the future of teaching.
Dude, it's like 2 a.m.
Oh, you're on Eastern time, aren't you? Oh, my bad. Did I wake you? And your wife? What a shame.
Oh, you. I am hanging up, and you submit an audio clip. Like everybody else.
Well, that was cold. Straight up cold.
You got to admire somebody who kindles that flame of revenge for that long.
Because revenge is a...
cool thing to do to someone.
Oh, come on. You can finish that sentence.
A dish best served cold.
Yeah, that was excellent. So that's... sort of gives away what we're going to be talking about today. You and I have been thinking about what it means to be teaching statistics, teaching quantitative methods in the 21st century. We're in the second quintile of this. Can we say that? Does that make sense?
This is why we have no friends.
Whatever. All right. We're in the second score of the 21st century, and I'm still not sure we have thought about what we're supposed to be doing in terms of teaching quantitative methods. And so you and I, as we are wont to do by now, when we have no idea what we're doing, increasingly we're asking other people what we ought to be doing. And so we did. We asked a number of people.
I kind of wish we had learned this subcontracting earlier. You know, early on, it was like, oh, maybe we can talk to Catherine Mason. And then 20 episodes later, what about Don Hedeker? That'd be great. And now it's just like, yeah, who can we get to do our episode for us this week?
Clock's ticking. Who's free? Anyone? All right. So I would like to start what we're about to get into with a story.
Please. I'm going to lay my head down on my desk and take a little bit of a nap since I woke up early today. So go right ahead.
As I ease into my story, I will ask you a question that should only have one answer, and that is, have you seen Austin Powers?
How long have we known each other?
There we go. Okay, of course.
Actually, my name is Austin Powers. Danger's my middle name.
You remember that Austin Powers was frozen, cryogenically preserved, and brought back decades later.
Han Solo-like.
Yes, Han Solo-like.
We only use this facility for carbon freezing. You put him in there, it might kill him.
We will test it on Captain Solo.
And of course, when he was thawed, there were all kinds of things for him to ease back into and to understand. But when he is thawed out, one of the first things he has to do is pee.
Stage 5. Evacuation beginning.
And so there's a scene of him peeing, and the computer keeps saying,
evacuation complete.
So I can't tell you how many mornings when my boys wake up, they will go to the bathroom and I can hear them actually say out loud, evacuation complete.
To live in your house.
Anyway, so I would like you to imagine that a university professor has been frozen, whether it's in carbonite or cryogenically preserved. and awakened 70 years later. And one of the first places that this person wants to go, we'll say he, is back to the university. And so he goes into one particular classroom and he's listening and he hears words like totipotent stem cells regenerating. He has no idea what they're talking about. And it turns out that it's a biology class. He doesn't even understand the language of the biology class. It's nothing like he remembers. And he wanders into a different classroom and he hears them talking about X-band radio waves to communicate with the Mars rover. And he's thinking, wow, so this is like a creative writing class or something. But it turns out it's an engineering class. And he just can't fathom that this is engineering. It's nothing like engineering as he ever even imagined. And he wanders into another classroom and he's there for about 10 seconds and he goes, oh, this is intro stats. That for me is where we are in our field. I feel like although there have been so many developments, we are still sort of stuck in the way we teach things. And I thought it would be good to have an episode where we try to get unstuck or at least get perspectives from a variety of people to help think about what we can do differently and what is reasonable to continue doing.
I took my first year grad stat sequence in the fall of 1988. So listeners, think about where you were in 1988. A whole lot of you weren't even born yet.
We need some 1988 music right here, by the way.
I'll cue up some Van Halen.
Sam Halen. Crap.
Don't start. One of my daughters gave me a playlist of workout music for Christmas, of her favorite workout songs.
Aww.
It was Aerosmith, Van Halen, Green Day.
Wow.
They're rediscovering Green Day, American Idiot. Don't wanna be an American idiot. It is actually fairly timely for right now.
It is.
Boy, I got off a little track there. But the first year sequence that I had is functionally the same thing we teach at Carolina right now. Mm-hmm. Everybody does things slightly differently, but the usual foundation is almost the first semester being an advanced undergrad class. It's kind of getting everybody back on the same page of the playbook, reminding things that maybe they had forgotten, teaching them things maybe they hadn't been exposed to, but just the core sampling distributions and null hypothesis testing. It'll often take you up through factorial ANOVA. And then second semester is a lot of places will peel back the layers of the onion on regression. But the general framework is what I had in 1988 and 1989.
Yeah, and one of the challenges is that in these introductory courses, we really do want to provide them a grounding that serves them well for all of the things to come. Part of the problem is that many of the things to come are things maybe that shouldn't. And then there's just the sheer problem of volume. The amount of things that exist today are so much more than the amount of things that existed back when you were listening to...
But I am going to defend the content of that first year sequence in the same way that I would like med students to know things about how a cell works and why you need skin and 11 reasons why we blink. I mean, these are like foundational kinds of things. And I think we still need to lay down that foundation. What I want to explore in the upcoming discussion is, one, what goes into that first year sequence? Two, through what lens do we present that foundational material? And then three, given that every time we open psych methods, there's something new that we got to go learn, then how do we expand what we define as foundational for an empirical researcher in the social ed behavioral sciences? So I think we should turn to some subcontractors to share their views, and then maybe you and I can repeat what they said, but then we could take credit for it. So really, the foundation of academia. So you reached out to people. Remind me what the prompt was when we asked them to submit audio clips.
It was really about the future of quantitative methods. And it was a long, rambling message. Having reread it, I don't know how people actually gleaned what the heck we wanted from it. But
could I interrupt briefly?
Yeah.
Didn't I write the message?
You did. I just was trying to be nice. Yes, but for those people who took the time to try and read the message and figure out what we wanted, I asked them a little bit about their thoughts about the future of quantitative method training, what kinds of things maybe we should be teaching, what kinds of things we shouldn't be teaching. But we left it quite open, and we reached out to a number of people. And I think it would be nice if we could use some of their words to inspire some conversation and reflection between us.
Hi, I'm Tasha Barefis, professor of quantitative methods in the educational psychology department at the University of Texas at Austin. In my opinion, there are some ways that we might be shortchanging our students. I think that we shortchange our graduate students by not requiring some core competencies while they're undergrads and before they leave being undergrads. I think students should have to master core concepts that have to do with research design and causal inference, as well as measurement, psychometrics. Not even the technical side, but some of the core concepts around validity and reliability of what scores mean and how they're used, as well as making them learn statistics before they complete their undergraduate degrees. And more importantly, if our graduate students come to us with those core competencies already, then we can all spend more time diving into some of those concepts in more depth.
I like, as a reflection of these people contributing these in the middle of their day jobs, was her little window sound that mm-hmm. you can hear as she's like doing email while recording.
Actually, that was me sending her an email saying, where the hell is your audio?
So there's several aspects of that that I really like. Just a moment ago, I said, well, a lot of times that first semester of the first year sequence is an enhanced undergrad class on core concepts. Mm-hmm. And I think there are a lot of advantages to that, especially within a particular department. You have a shared view of the field, you start working on a shared notational system, things like that. But it is true that if we didn't have to start the very first semester with a review of core concepts, yeah, that alone would provide bandwidth to expand in other kinds of ways.
Yeah, I agree with everything that she said. And, you know, statistics training is starting earlier. All three of my kids went to the lab school on our campus, and I remember walking by a bar chart that the kids had created. They're 4 years old, what their favorite pie was. And it made me smile because the idea that kids were thinking about data at that time and ways to represent and visualize those data, I think, was spectacular. Now it's fairly routine to offer statistics at the high school level, and the curriculum is very similar to the kinds of things that we've historically taught in our introductory statistics course. I wish all of that were required. Now, that feels really, really self-serving, but then you look at all the things that go on in the media with regard to reporting data, with regard to study design, as Tasha said, issues of validity, issues of measurement. I absolutely wish that the population as a whole spoke that language. I think they would be, as we said before, much better critical consumers of all the kinds of things that go on. Boy, that would make the graduate experience so much better.
Even if a kid never goes to grad school, having these core concepts is critically important in an increasingly data-driven society that we live in. Devil's advocate, on the first day of class for the first year sequence in a grad program, we have to assume that everybody has the same level of exposure and training and understanding. Mm-hmm. And so we can't just say, oh, we're going to assume all of these things and now start teaching more advanced concepts right out of the gate. Somehow there has to be maybe a boot camp. Some universities do a 5-day preparing for grad school.
Exactly.
There are a lot of clever ways of doing that, whether you mm-hmm. do that in your own department or you share it across departments. But I feel very, very strongly making sure that every single person in the room has had the same kinds of opportunity as everybody else mm-hmm. to move forward in the more advanced topics. Mm-hmm. Let's turn to our next guest.
All right.
Hi, everyone. My name is Amanda Montoya. I'm an assistant professor of quantitative psychology at UCLA. I'm interested in talking about the statistics training programs for graduate students in social sciences. What we know is that there is a lot of focus on this single year introductory course at most programs. And there are some additional classes that students take above and beyond that, but really the core element is this single year course. Typically in that course, we cover topics like t-tests, ANOVA, sampling distributions, regression, correlation, kind of the core elements that we see in so many different textbooks. The current problem that we're running into is that these topics are not enough for a researcher in today's field. So most researchers will need more advanced methods when they go out and do their research. And we're increasingly seeing this at UCLA, even where by the time someone's doing their dissertation, they need much more advanced methods than are available in that single year of training. The current solution seems to be to try to cram more in, whether that is more classes or to put more content in that single year class. I'm concerned about that solution because I worry that it will result in a lower quality education about these kind of core topics. What I would like to advocate for actually is a kind of new thinking about the way that we approach that introductory year, where as an instructor, perhaps I've been approaching this class and thinking about how do I teach these students everything that they're going to need to know for the rest of their career? And I think that that expectation is just unreasonable. How do I teach students how to learn the things that they will know for the rest of their career? And that's slightly different in that I don't necessarily have to teach it to them. If I can teach them mechanisms for learning, and to me, that's what a PhD is all about. I try to focus in my classes thinking about how do I make sure that students, even if I don't cover certain topics, that they feel comfortable learning those on their own outside of the classroom if they need them. So for example, in my mediation moderation course, when we get to multiple moderator models, the students actually do an in-class activity where they either learn about additive moderation or multiplicative moderation, and then they do some peer teaching to teach somebody else in the other group. And I think that modeling after these types of ideas where we give students practice learning new ideas in the classroom, not just teaching them, but guided learning so that they're prepared to learn new methods, I think that will really advance the training and quality of research in our field and help researchers feel comfortable breaking into new ground when it comes to statistics.
One of the things that she alluded to and something that you mentioned previously has to do with this one-year block of training. I think we can't have 1 year of training, period. I don't think the issue is just how do we rethink the first year, because I actually agree with you that there's a lot of very good foundational stuff, just like for med school. We want them to know 11 reasons people blink. Was that it? But 1 year just simply isn't enough. I think that there should be at least 2 years. And I don't mean this in a self-serving way that we want to fill our classrooms with more people that we serve from the outside. But I think if anybody in an applied field opens up a journal, they will not see the things that typically get covered in that first year. I mean, they will a bit, but they're going to see so much more. I know that most of the programs that our courses serve here at Maryland, people are taking at least 2 years worth of quantitative methods. And even that, I think, is, you might need a little bit more. And that's hard because they have their own curricula. But the idea of 1 year serving, I think that has to be off the table.
I see a couple of things to ponder. One is what you said, moving beyond the first year. And I think a lot of these are institutionally dependent and what the culture is, but also the culture crossed with the ability to teach these classes. We had that wonderful conversation over the summer with Becca Brock, who was at Nebraska, and she desperately wanted to have a dozen advanced classes, but they don't have the personnel to do that. And she was working in very clever and creative ways to make that happen with the limited resources that they had at that time. So part of it is the culture of the place. For example, at Carolina, we offer a concentration in quantitative psychology for people outside of the quant doctoral program. And in addition to the first year sequence, you have to take 4 more advanced classes. The vast majority of grad students at Carolina get the quant concentration, which means that they have up to 6 advanced classes in quantitative methods. Now, we're very lucky in that we can offer those having the quant program, and a whole lot of universities are not able to. But the second point for me on the first year sequence is I don't mind talking about null hypothesis testing and sampling variability and multiple regression. couple of episodes ago is I talked about my love affair with the multiple regression model and how it's verging on magic. I don't want to jettison that, and I don't want to just add to that, but I would like to think about, is there a different lens through which we could teach these things?
So one of the things that Amanda mentions is having students contribute to the curriculum by helping each other to learn some more advanced topics. I like that in the abstract. You know, formalizing that in some way would certainly take some work. But the idea about students taking responsibility for learning things themselves, communicating that, I like that idea a lot. And I think that segues well into our next call.
Hi, my name is Tracy Sweet from the University of Maryland. And I've been thinking a lot about how we're preparing our students. And aside from coursework and research and the mentee-mentor relationship, I think there's one other thing that doesn't get mentioned that much, and it's something that I found personally invaluable. But I think every student getting a PhD needs to leave their program with the ability to be able to learn on their own. And what I mean by that is if they want to learn about some topic, right? Maybe they want to learn about machine learning algorithms, or they want to teach themselves Python, that they should have the ability to do that. They should be able to pick up a textbook, read a few blog posts, watch a YouTube video, whatever, but to be able to teach themselves that content without having to be in a classroom setting with a formal instructor. I think that skill is so important, mainly because of what our lives are right now. I mean, post-PhD, regardless of whether you're in industry or in academia, what are you doing? You're spending your career learning things. So the question is now, how do we teach our students this skill? How do we teach students to teach themselves to learn things on their own? I'm not 100% sure of this answer, but I think it's just providing opportunities. I think I picked up this skill mainly because I had really poor instructors in graduate school. And so if I wasn't able to learn things on my own, I wouldn't be here today. I don't suggest that we all become terrible instructors. I don't think that's the answer. But I do think providing situations or creating situations in which our students are kind of forced to learn things on their own. And I think this should happen prior to the dissertation stage. So someone's dissertation should not be the first time they are asked to learn something on their own. And perhaps it's the required independent studies that all PhD students have to do, or a required project type course. I'm not sure. I don't have an answer to that part, but I do think the general answer is just providing opportunities, because the more practice students get, the better it is, the easier it is, the more likely they will graduate from our programs with this skill.
So all of those years of Sunday school finally paid off. The difference between giving a person a fish and teaching a person how to fish.
You did learn something in Sunday school.
Did you see that, Mom?
We're on a mission from God.
Do you know what I did learn? So for you Catholics out there who have gone through confession, you know that one of the things that you say is, I am heartily sorry for my sins. I was 19 years old when I understood that I was not saying, I am hardly sorry for my sins. And I'm like, oh, that makes so much more sense.
Okay. I don't really know how to follow up your Sunday school and confessional. I like what Tracy says about, I'm not suggesting we all become poor instructors, as though we're all good instructors now.
In 1930, the Republican-controlled House of Representatives, in an effort to alleviate the effects of the, anyone? Great Depression.
I would like to take her key point here and contrast it with a medical model. In a medical model, the way I see it is that our understanding of things medical is constantly expanding, whether it's with regard to human physiology, the treatments, the medications. And so there is continuing education that's required. There's, you know, recertification, which I 100% support. But those are still things that are arranged to be delivered. So essentially, you have to go sign up to do these particular continuing certification activities. What Tracy is talking about is just instilling the capacity for people to be able to acquire this knowledge on their own. Not that you tell people, all right, well, you want to make sure that you keep taking workshops. I mean, that may be one source of how you help yourself to learn things. But I think her point is that we have to create this capacity within people to be able to say, I want to go learn about this now. There's something new out there in the world. There are dynamic structural equation models that didn't exist when I was in graduate school. How am I going to learn that? I'm going to go figure this out myself. And I think it's a really good point where you are sending people out into a world that is constantly expanding its technical knowledge base. So the question is, how do we do it?
I think she is absolutely spot on that we could do a better job of structuring how do you teach someone to learn something new. I'm going to be the grumpy old man, though, a little bit. Okay, they release a new version of the 737. Southwest pilots are not told to Google the manual and figure out what those new switches are on the panel.
And we hope you enjoy the rest of your flight. By the way, is there anyone on board who knows how to fly a plane?
I think there's a sweet spot in seeking things out on your own, but also having structured guidance in how to do it from the experts. The other thing that I will equally be a grumpy old man about is I think it's a mindset. You and I have talked about this before. The notion that in grad school, not necessarily everything you need to know is going to be presented in a classroom. Mm-hmm. It's just realizing that if you're in an effective program, you are going to be given all the fundamentals that you need. You are going to be given the scaffolding you need to seek out what is unique to your own program of study.
Yeah.
But I think that we err on saying, well, Google it.
Right.
And that's not helpful.
Yeah, I remember Goldie was having a surgery, and she met with the surgeon the night before, and on his way out of her room after they'd had a conversation, he just said sort of to the room, "No worries, I watched a YouTube video," as he walked out. I really agree, and I don't know what it is, but I completely agree with Tracy that the dissertation is not the time for this to be happening. Honestly, by the time a person gets to the dissertation, I would like to think of them as really close to autopilot, that they have developed a program of involvement in research, a program of having to dig into things on their own. Part of the way that I try to create that, not that I have the answer, but as students go through a lot of our sort of, quote, upper-level courses, almost every one of them has some kind of project associated with it. And almost all of those projects are not just straight applications of something that you've learned. It requires you to dig into the literature and figure things out. So I think we have to try to take the structure that we have and not just create people who can understand things that are fed to them, but know how to resolve their problems themselves. And I think about the only structures that we have are the context of the classrooms that we have or other things that we arrange for this learning to take place as part of our program.
We should hit them early with undergrad.
Mm-hmm.
The first year sequence is not enough.
Yep.
We need to teach how to learn. So what that does, I think, is pivots us then, well, what are the additional things that an empirical researcher needs to have at their fingertips to navigate the increasingly complex world that we live in? So let's turn to a few suggestions about, okay, wise guy, if the first year sequence isn't enough, what should we be doing additionally?
Hey there, QPod listeners. Andrea Howard here. I'm a former UNC postdoc in Patrick's lab, reformed academic stalker, and current associate professor of psychology at Carleton University in sunny Ottawa, Canada. I've been teaching ANOVA and regression, SEM, multi-level modeling, and factor analysis at the grad level for nearly 8 years. And one thing I want to talk about is our need to shift our focus, at least in teaching, away from parameter estimation and onto parameter uncertainty. So what do I mean by that exactly? Well, if I'm backing up, I can remember being a grad student myself and getting excited about stats when I started to get the impression that I could use it to like reveal hidden truths about human behavior. So I was super eager to move past the basics and start accumulating courses and workshops in one special topic after another. I see that same fascination developing in students in my department. And they're like, yes, I heard about this new cool thing, and now I need a course in machine-directed latent mixture basket weaving in R right now. Thank you. So I love their enthusiasm, but I'm also worried that our teaching approach puts this laser focus on parameter estimates at the expense of an equally rich and complex appreciation for the uncertainty around those estimates. We're not necessarily pausing to also ask, is that finding even plausible? Is there any chance I'd observe that in another data set? And other related questions that can get students to interrogate their group difference or their path coefficient or their mediated moderation or whatever as one estimate among many possible estimates with differing degrees of conclusivity about your hypothesis attached to each one. What would I recommend? For starters, I might say, let's teach undergrad students stats with simulation a lot more. Let them see for themselves what a sampling distribution looks like and what group differences can come out of totally uncorrelated data, for example. We should probably also be using confidence intervals not just to ask whether it contains zero, but to draw conclusions about how conclusive or inconclusive a parameter estimate is based on what general range of values it covers. At the grad level, we should probably build more data interrogation skills into the foundational courses we do offer. And that would mean stopping the practice of making the standard error like a sidekick in our PowerPoints on how to estimate whatever new cool thing we're working on.
One of the things that I like about this, besides the basket weaving, what the heck was that?
Oh, I'm already registered.
Okay, that was brilliant.
In R right now, thank you.
Yeah.
They're so polite in Ottawa.
What I really like about that is that she is turning toward not just content that ought to be in our classes, but the ways we approach that content, the ways we help students to think about that content. A couple of the themes that I heard in what she was saying, one is we need students to have their hands on what they're doing. And when she says to teach through simulation, that means when you're learning about a sampling distribution, have students actually generate sampling distributions themselves, to watch it, to internalize that concept about what happens upon repeated sampling, rather than just saying, and here is the standard error of the mean, which is a function of, you know, show them, have them build them themselves. I like the idea because what that helps to do is to internalize the notion of uncertainty. And she said the phrase that it's not just a sidekick, it's not just a standard error that helps us to test the thing that we really care about, but also to be able to frame it as to our business is the business of uncertainty. The idea that our business isn't just about estimating one particular value, but it's understanding something about the space in which these truths, in which these processes could exist. So I like that as a mindset for entering into what we do.
It links back to some things we just talked about a few minutes ago about maybe covering the same kind of material that we do in the first year sequence, but present it through a different lens.
Mm-hmm.
And that's along the lines, I think, that apply here. So for example, we often, and I don't feel bad about this, is I feel like it's a cornerstone of what we do, but this notion of null hypothesis testing about having some unknown fixed parameter that exists beyond the horizon, and we can't see it, but we believe it to be there,
mm-hmm.
and that we're trying to recover a point estimate of that fixed parameter. And that leads all the way to the really nice conversation about type 1 error and type 2 error and power and all of those things. I'm not minimizing that at all. But then we don't come back to that later and talk about the distribution of the point estimates around there. And one thing I joke about in my own classes is if you could have a t-shirt made that just said, respect sampling variability.
Mm-hmm.
Just respect it, that things happen. The very cornerstone of what we do involves this uncertainty.
So let's continue with some other folks' ideas about whether it's specific topics that we want to make sure we introduce people to and or ways of thinking about those particular topics. So go ahead and queue up our next guest.
My name is Steve Culpepper. I am an associate professor in the Department of Statistics at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. For the past 15 years or so, I've had the opportunity to conduct research and teach in the area of quantitative methods. And in the past year, I've also served as the editor for the Journal of Educational and Behavioral Statistics, where I've had an opportunity to review advanced methods as well as, have a chance to really reflect on what are the implications of these novel innovations for graduate student training. And so one issue to consider in this conversation relates to providing students with exposure to what we might call modern machine learning algorithms. as researchers continue to develop new methods, you know, a challenge is going to be that the list of topics that students should know and be critical consumers of, it's going to continue to grow. And so as an example, our students in quantitative methods should be proficient with procedures and techniques such as structural equation modeling and multi-level modeling. And they also need to have a strong foundation in understanding issues related to study design and knowing how to identify and mitigate threats to internal validity. And so in addition to these topics, students would benefit possibly from learning about algorithms that are emerging from what we could call this data science revolution. And these algorithms are really going to be critical to understand as they are being applied more broadly to inform decisions in industry and in government. And so given that these machine learning algorithms are being, you know, widely disseminated, we can expect to see more and more applications of them in educational, psychological, and behavioral research settings. And so as we consider revising, you know, existing quantitative methods curriculum, yeah, we should definitely consider the ways to provide students with more insights about these methods so that they can also be critical consumers of these advanced techniques.
Well, obviously, I like all the things that Steve said about it's critical that we introduce people to make them familiar with structural equation modeling, multi-level modeling, design, validity, all of that. The most intriguing part of what he's saying for me has to do with not just the acknowledgement of, but the incorporation of things that fall under the domain of data science. And he mentioned machine learning specifically and a lot of the algorithms associated with that. I mean, he feels strongly that we ought to start incorporating that. And I would say that's not a position without controversy, because the machine learning world, and you and I have poked at it a little bit just for fun, or data science, it is out there. It is huge. It is a place where people with quantitative skills are getting jobs. The key for me is trying to figure out where it fits into what we do. Now, there's a lot of stuff that we already do that falls under the broad banner of machine learning, but how do we weave that in?
My perspective links back to some things we talked about a few minutes ago, and I don't mean to belabor this point, but I see this as another instance of adjusting our way of thinking about how we approach our science, how we approach data, and making empirically based inferences about the world around us. And when we're pistol whipped into the notion that there is the single fixed gamma beyond the horizon, that our quest is to go out and find it, that is not always consistent with a machine learning kind of perspective. But a machine learning kind of perspective is hugely consistent with maybe some things that we already do in our field that we don't think about that way. So you and I talked about the good, bad, and the ugly of factor analysis, and that exploratory factor analysis isn't exploratory and confirmatory factor analysis isn't confirmatory. And as long as you're cool with that, everything is fine. Mm-hmm. There's a gradient of exploration to confirmation, and very often as a field, we're already somewhere out on that gradient, whether we're looking at modification indices, whether we're looking at competing models, whether we're doing sensitivity analyses. A lot of these things are non-algorithmic machine learning-like approaches. Mm-hmm. I like his comment about the algorithms.
Yeah.
How are we automating this in a principled way? But for me, the broader lens to see this through is thinking about what our motivation, mission, intent is, and how can these types of procedures help us meet the goals that we've set out for ourselves.
The source of the challenge that I'm having with this, and I'll also tell you the way I kind of reconcile it, is that I think of myself and I think of the field that I have chosen as being a field of explanation, not a field of prediction. I think of a lot of the skills that are associated with machine learning algorithms to be aimed at predicting things, not necessarily aimed at understanding them. I think generally speaking, when you can explain things, when you understand the mechanisms, then you will also be relatively good at predicting. But I think that when you can predict things, you're not necessarily very good at explaining or understanding them. And so the question for me, if that's a reasonable premise, where do these methods fit into what I consider largely explanatory systems? And for me, most of what we do, it's a fairly linear world. And a lot of the data science algorithms, methods, has to do with linking the variables that you're interested in different ways. Not making yourself beholden to a linear function, but rather having some more complex connection. But I can see that as being reasonably embedded within a framework that is geared toward explaining things. I agree that this needs to be woven in. I just want to make sure that it is done carefully. I don't want it to hijack our thinking.
Really, what you're tapping into is more of a philosophy of science kind of issue, is how do we think about the world? How do we think about the mechanisms that brought us data? How do we think about what we do with those data to make inferences back to those mechanisms? And maybe in thinking about how do we expand our curriculum and our training, that having some thoughtful discussions about a philosophy of science-like approach to ways of knowing, inductive reasoning, deductive reasoning, stuff that's above my pay grade, but that I would really like someone to guide me through a conversation, mm-hmm. I think I personally could really benefit from.
And that brings us to Roy.
That
I feel like we kind of have to play his audios now. And when I say audios, he sent us a lot of stuff, right? If I'm going to wake you up late at night, I'm going to make it count, right?
There's a term I like of no half measures. If you're going to do something, just do it.
The moral of the story is I chose a half measure when I should have gone all the way. I'll never make that mistake again.
I think Roy has no half measures.
No half measures at all. So why don't we queue up the first of
the Levy series?
The Levy series. Yeah, see what you got.
You guys had me on the show to talk about Bayes. So naturally, when it comes to thinking about the future of teaching, I'm going to say we should be teaching more Bayes. And in fact, we should be getting that in early in our curriculum. These days, it tends to be taught as something like a special topic or an advanced seminar or something like that. But I think it could really pervade everything we do. There's a great quote from Dennis Lindley who said, "Bayes is not a branch of statistics. It is a way of looking at all of statistics." And it could be taught that way. We sneak it in here and there. We offer trainings and workshops, and I'm fortunate enough to teach multiple courses on it, but it could come much earlier on in our training and really pervade a lot of what we do.
Shocker.
Yeah. Yeah, the Bayes guy wants to teach more Bayes.
Huh. What do you think about that?
He could sell a freezer to a penguin. Yeah, and given that I only bring no more than one point to any episode and I just repeat it over and over again, it's a lens. It's a way of viewing, and I like that. It's not just a branch of statistics, but it's that notion of how do we approach the statistical modeling of our observed data? Mm-hmm. There's a complementary way of thinking about this and introducing that early on. I like that a lot.
I like the idea also that it represents a mental model for science also, and the formal incorporation of what has been learned from prior studies, which we are epically bad at, really, right? Even within our traditional framework, where we have the opportunity to test specific parameter values, we pretty much never do that. What we do is we just keep estimating the same values over and over and over, rather than testing what we have learned so far. So I like what he's saying as a way to frame what has been done, to give potential weight to what has been done in the things that we do. I will say from a curricular standpoint, I don't know how to weave it in without burning everything down and starting from the ground up. And I'm not even saying we shouldn't do that. But I like this idea. I just have to figure out what to do with it.
I think there's an easing into it that we could do, because part of it goes back to the philosophy of science issue, is Bayesian as a way of knowing. Mm-hmm. Moving from the probability of A given B to the probability of B given A, and just what does that mean? What are the implications? What changes do we need in thinking about the world? It's a next stage to talk about all the cool ways that you go about doing that, mm-hmm. and using awesome terms like burn-in and thinning out and MCMC. Oh, it's just awesome.
Oh, stochastic convergence. Oh.
That's a different issue of how do you do it. I do think that it would be very consistent with rethinking the broader presentation of what we do as a whole, of saying, look, we've spent a lot of time talking about what is the probability of the data given some unknown status in the population. What does it mean about what is the probability of this hypothesis given the characteristics of the data? And just talk about in a more 30,000 foot perspective, how do we go about our business differently if we have that as an approach?
And this actually leads into the next in the Levy series. So maybe we could just go into that and talk about them collectively.
I also think as a field, we got to take much more of a modeling orientation. You guys have talked a lot about this on the podcast, pushing us away from hypothesis testing thinking and more towards a estimation or modeling orientation or frame of thinking. So much of our training starts with things like null hypothesis testing, and then somewhere along the way it flips into models, structural equation models, multi-level models, longitudinal models, psychometric models, missing data models, whatever. Well, all those early hypothesis testing situations that we learn about, they could be framed and really taught from a modeling orientation. And another kind of related idea comes from, well, it's really best expressed by a quote that I like from John Tukey, who said something to the effect of, it's far better to get an approximate answer to the right question, which is often vague, than to get an exact answer to the wrong question, which can always be made more precise. To me, modeling is the right question. Hypothesis testing, or the dichotomous thinking that underlies hypothesis testing, is often the wrong question. We teach stats early on to say, you calculate the p-value to the fourth decimal place, and that's the answer, with precision. But that's a precise answer to the wrong question. There's far more of a vague notion in our analysis than we let on early on, but we should teach people that way. There's far more subjectivity in our analyses. And I don't use that as a bad or pejorative term. We need to get people and our students comfortable with that kind of vagueness or subjectivity, perhaps only having an approximate answer to the right question. We got to get people comfortable with the uncertainty or disagreements that may come out of different analyses. And another kind of related theme that I think is super important to teach throughout is that analyses are purpose-oriented. We teach things like, if your data look like this, do this, as if that's like the one right thing to do in each situation. But in fact, we might have different models or different analyses depending on the purpose. The fact that all of our models are wrong means we shouldn't go about searching for the right model of the situation. And I'm good with that. I'm good with entertaining or using different models on the same data for different purposes.
There's so much good stuff in there. What resonated with you primarily?
The tie back to Andrea's comment about uncertainty, because I think that underlies a lot of it, not just uncertainty and sampling variability, but the subjectivity, that purpose-oriented analysis and modeling. I really like that term. I've not heard that before, and I like that. And I'm going to steal it and not credit him,
Sure. Mostly
for the middle of the night call. And it goes back to prior discussions you and I have had about the whiteboard problem and you and your Sharpie. Mm-hmm. And you draw out your measured variables in permanent marker. And then everything we do is, what about this? What about this? Maybe this. Mm-hmm. Well, could we compare it to this? So I respond positively to a lot of that. I have a standard joke I use. As you know, I only have 3 jokes.
Yeah.
If anybody tells you that the thing they love most about statistics is how objective it is, how it's cut and dried, how that it's a clear insight into your data, if anybody tells you that, you immediately know that they know nothing about statistics.
Yep.
The simplest analysis you can imagine is subjective in some way or another. This goes back to that lens through which to see what we're doing is embracing the subjectivity.
What Roy described is exactly correct, and that is that we lead people through 1, 2, 3, 4 courses where we don't use that kind of language, don't use that kind of framing. And then all of a sudden, we're talking about models and assessing data model fit and all of these things. It's like a whole new language. And I know personally, I have tried to use model-based language in my earlier courses, even if I'm teaching stuff that's very standard, sampling distributions, hypothesis testing, all of that. I always try to give it the parallel model language so that it helps people to think that way. So it also facilitates an easier transition when we get to more formal model-based approaches as we talk about them.
It's consistent with the title of Joe Rogers' paper that we talked about in that modeling conversation we had about a quiet revolution.
Yes.
But there are books that are embracing this more. So Scott Maxwell's most recent one is model-based. Dave Flora, who is at York University, wrote a wonderful book a few years ago approaching all of these different kinds of analytic strategies explicitly from a model-based framework. Hang on, I'm going to go grab it. So just a second. It's back at Cat's Cradle, and I'm going to hang on. Oh, here's Building the Suez Canal, John Wesley Powell's biography. Here we go. All right, so I grabbed two books. One is Naval History of Pacific Warfare, 1941 to 1942. It is a 1,000-page book that is the first of three volumes.
Okay.
So just to give you a reflection of where my life is right now. But here's Dave's book, Statistical Methods for the Social and Behavioral Sciences, A Model-Based Approach.
Nice.
I highly recommend this book. The first chapter, Foundations of Statistical Modeling Demonstrated with Simple Regression. And then he goes into a couple of chapters on regressions and interactions, then multi-level modeling, exploratory factor, SEM, path analysis, latent variable growth curve modeling. My only point is, I think the field is moving in this direction, but maybe we could make it a little bit more intentioned.
Yeah.
As part of a curriculum.
And what I said previously with regard to Bayesian methods holds here, and that is it's very, very hard to redo things that you have already been doing. But if we designed a curriculum from the ground up right now and didn't go back to the same file drawers that we had gone to for our current curriculum, I think this would be and should be really prominent from day one in terms of helping people to think about things. That, along with the issues of uncertainty and sampling and some of the Bayesian stuff, a lot of the things that have come so far, I think really come together to help shape the way that people ought to be thinking from day one. Okay, should we go ahead and roll another of Roy's clips?
Another Roy clip.
I think there were five total.
So Midnight Boy submitted five clips when we asked for maybe 2 minutes.
Yeah, he's an overachiever.
Let me think a moment. Who woke me up at 2 a.m.? Screw him. I think we're done with Dr. Levy.
All right, then.
Let's hear what somebody who actually follows instructions has to say.
Roll tape.
Hi, I'm Dan McNeish, and I'm an associate professor in quantitative psychology at Arizona State University, where I teach undergraduate statistics and graduate courses on multi-level modeling, longitudinal data analysis, and statistical computing. And when asked about teaching, the expanded interest in teaching methods courses is undoubtedly a good thing for behavioral sciences in general. But the one thing I always wonder teaching methods courses in a psychology department is how well our quantitative courses are actually serving our own students whose primary focus is in a niche area like quantitative methods. And so with an influx of empirical researchers into advanced quantitative classes, the content of those classes changes a little to accommodate the broader interests and backgrounds of those students. So when you're teaching a course for a more diverse audience, you got to consider the balance between practical aspects or information about specific software and the more abstract technical details that method students really benefit from to understand what's going on under the hood statistically. And that's useful for them to develop their own methodological research questions and advance their own careers. And so simulation studies, I think, are a prime example of this, where if you open any methodological journal, you'll see simulation studies all over the place because it's a method that's really central to conducting methodological research and publishing in those types of journals. But a lot of quantitative curricula punt simulation to its special topic course that's offered less frequently than the Summer Olympics. Or the expectation is that students will just pick up simulation design and simulation execution from their advisors in one-on-one meetings. And this is somewhat understandable because quant classes are always in such high demand, and quant researchers often have lower teaching allocations because of high involvement with grant-funded projects. So departments justifiably don't want to burn that limited teaching allocation on a simulation class targeted to a handful of quant students when there's so much pent-up demand for service-oriented classes for a broader array of students who may need those courses to complete their thesis or their dissertation. But the shifting composition of quant classes and the concessions we make to balance the course content sometimes feels like we're turning our backs a little on our own students, because nearly all of our course offerings are tailored toward people in other areas. So our students kind of get left out, and I think their development might end up being delayed a little bit as a result, because the beginning of their program kind of trains them like empirical researchers looking at methods as a data analysis tool, which I think all of this combined perpetuates treating quant like a service to the other areas in behavioral science, rather than as an independent area with its own challenges and approaches to inquiry that are not always of interest to non-quant students.
Amen.
He is not wrong.
Yeah, absolutely. It is a challenge that we face. In fact, it's such a big challenge that it feels like a can of worms worth opening more fully, right? Because on this point, regarding both the balancing of the needs of our service students with our own students, and then more fully the types of things that we need to be doing specifically for quantitative methods students, I feel a whole episode in that, to be honest.
I think there is a tension. I think it is a good tension. I would see this as a good problem to have, that people want to take these classes, that people need to take these classes, that we in the quantitative methods are able to contribute to a broad array of research applications in our disciplines.
Mm-hmm.
But he is spot on. I won't even drill into that because maybe we could save that for another episode.
So maybe this is a nice wrapping up point. Maybe what we should do up to this point is just agree to ignore Dan McNeish and summarize some of the things that we have that we've talked about so far. But what would you say are some of the key takeaways from this that are things that we should be thinking about as we shape curricula for the future?
Nice judo move there to throw that back onto me as I have my feet up on my desk and I'm pouring more coffee. So I don't believe we need to scrap the current system and build a new one. First, that's not realistic.
Mm-hmm.
But second, there is a lot of really good stuff that we already do. And I think a lot of that can be retained. If I skimmed over the points raised by these really remarkable contributions, all the different ways that people are clearly giving this a lot of thought themselves,
mm-hmm.
I think we need the first year sequence in a form that is kind of similar to what it is right now, but maybe cast it through a different lens, build a different framework,
mm-hmm.
draw in a model-based perspective,
mm-hmm.
talk about subjectivity, talk about those purpose-based analyses as really as we bring people into the system.
Yeah, I like all the things that you said about that for the curriculum. And what I would weave in is some of the other points that were made. And that is, without crushing the souls of our introductory students, I would still like to have their hands a little bit dirtier on generating some things for themselves to be able to feel that uncertainty. And that was a theme that Andrea, I think, contributed nicely to all of that. So yeah, I think not a total scrapping, but a rethinking. But I would like to see us actually doing that. And I think we have to be doing that. We have to be modeling some of that language in the classes that we teach. We have to be modeling those hands-on things. We have to be modeling those discussions of uncertainty and the things that we're doing in that first year sequence.
I think here's where we can wrap up. Before Levy emails us another damn audio clip, I think we should put an end to this.
I hope that this conversation has maybe at least gotten some people's juices flowing out there thinking about their own curricula, whether it might be at the introductory first year level or maybe some things for the future, ways that you approach things. It certainly has gotten mine thinking a little bit more about how we do things in our program. So thank you very much. And thank you to everybody. They were just terrific.
To be willing to publicly associate yourself with us, we deeply appreciate. Are we actually done?
I think we're done. I mean, it feels like we're done, but I'm not entirely sure.
Then we are done? Dude, are we done or are we not done?
Evacuation complete.
Complete. Hey, Couponers, don't forget to tell your friends to check us out on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever they usually go during that first month of New Year's resolution treadmill sessions. You can also follow us on Twitter, where we are at QuantitudePod, and visit our website, quantitudepod.org, where you can leave us a message and listen to past episodes. And finally, be an even cooler kid with Quantitude merch on redbubble.com, where all proceeds go to donorschoose.org to help support remote access in low-income schools. You've been listening to Quantitude, the true crime podcast where the victim is an hour of your life. Today's episode was sponsored by the Messiverse, evil twin to the Tidyverse, and by Serial Correlation, perfect for modeling the dynamic relation between your Lucky Charms and Honey Nut Cheerios consumption. And finally, by the Monty Hall problem, or as Bayesians refer to it, foreplay. This is most definitely not NPR.